This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guests on Keeping the Faith today are talking about student activism on the University of Illinois campus, and we have three current students at the university in the studio. Joe Tang is with us, who is president of the University YMCA and has been very active in Students for Environmental Concerns for many of his years here on campus. We also have Ellen Dahlke, who is involved with a tutoring program that we'll be hearing about today in the public schools, private schools here in the Champaign-Urbana area. And Jen Gaddis, who is with Engineers Without Borders. And we're going to be talking about, among other things, education reform from that perspective. So we're very happy to have these students with us today here on Keeping the Faith. We're having a little bit of a technical problem, and at least on my headphones, I'm hearing some static. We'll try to get that taken care of. Let's try turning off that. Yes, please, see if that helps. Nope, that didn't do it. Let's try this next one. All right, nope, no, that didn't seem to help us. The engineers will be working with us for a moment. And we'll do, we found it. We found the right button to push. Great. All right, we're live on Keeping the Faith, as our listeners can tell, and this is a live call-in show on WILL AM 580 every Sunday evening from 5 to 6. Listeners who have comments or questions may call us in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. If it's a long-distance call for you, and this program is heard as far away as Chicago, Indianapolis, and, of course, on the Internet all over the country, do call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. So, if it's a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. So, back to our guest talking about student activism. Joe Tang, let's start with you. You're involved with Students for Environmental Concerns. Tell us about that group.
Sure. Students for Environmental Concerns, we are the oldest environmental group on campus. We were established in 1969, and we've always been a program at the Y. We have a long tradition of, you know, just kind of increasing environmental awareness on campus and around the community. And our most recent success was the passage of the student sustainability fee. And I'd like to just give some background on that because this is really a kind of a big milestone in the university. So SCCS, we worked to put a petition, or we worked to put a referendum on the student ballot that was just here up in March. And the referendum that we got was, do you support the creation of a $5 refundable student fee to help establish a sustainable campus environment by financing such initiatives as green buildings, the engagement of the university community, recycling, energy efficiency, and environmentally responsible purchasing?
So that was the actual text of what students voted on. Was that in January, you say?
No, it was in March, with March. The student trustee and all the LAS student body or student government. So, yeah, that was a referendum that was on there that we got put on the ballot.
Just earlier this month?
Yes.
Great. And what was the result?
Well, out of the 8,851 students who voted for this referendum in particular, we had 7,000 voted in favor. So it was an overwhelming passage of the referendum. We got about 80% of the students who voted for that fee wanted it passed. So it was really a great success for what we could do at SCCS, and we really hope that this fee will kind of continue what we've been trying to do, but you know, just only more so because now we have a significant amount of funding that we want to use to help build a more sustainable campus environment.
Now, there was a similar fee that students voted to sort of self-tax themselves for environmental things, sustainable energy. 2 years ago?
Yeah, that was 4 years ago. Jen Walling, she was president of SCCS then. They worked on getting a $2 fee passed on. It was a clean energy technology fee, and that could be used for kind of energy efficiency, purchasing renewable energy, and that's actually been very, very successful as well. To date, over the past 4 years, we've with that fee, we've transferred about $671,000 to 7 different projects on campus, everything from buying a new ethanol tank for the campus fleet, a biodiesel project, our biggest project with that is there's going to be a wind farm going on in the South Farms. We're going to have 3 wind turbines. that are going to produce about 3% of the university's electricity.
Now, for listeners who are far away and may not understand how this particular university is laid out and how it works, tell us what the South Farms are.
The South Farms is just a huge tract of land extending south from the university. There's obviously a lot of agricultural research that goes down there. I think we have like a meat science lab. I'm not sure the exact size, but since we are a land-grant university, I think, and we've also solely purchased a lot of land down there. It's used for, there's nature reserves, all sorts of things down there.
So the College of Agriculture, ACES as they call it here, has a lot of acres, and that's where these wind-generating windmills will be.
Exactly. Hopefully we'll get those up within the next 2 years. But actually one of the biggest problems we've had is that around the nation, demand for wind turbines is so high that we're having a hard time getting the three turbines that we want because there are projects going up around the country that want hundreds of wind turbines.
Sure.
So we're literally like a drop in the bucket for these large wind turbine producers.
But this will be the first state university to have such things.
We believe it's the first. It'll be the largest wind farm on any college campus in the nation. I believe a couple of other universities might have one wind farm, but this is definitely going to be the largest one that we know of.
Now, tell me again, why would students vote to pay more money to the university? They're already paying tuition. They're already having to pay for a place to live and food and everything else. Why would they vote to tax themselves?
Well, I guess that's a good question. The clean energy fee was only $2 a semester, and SECS then, we kind of saw that as more of, you know, just to show what could be done with as little as $2. And, you know, we've already gone a long way with that. And then we kind of decided, well, hey, you know, sustainability as a whole isn't just about energy. It's about environmental issues, social issues, and, of course, economic issues as well. And I like to see why the students would vote for this is because they're becoming more and more well aware of how important it is, you know, that we take care of the environment. We become stewards of, you know, natural areas. And that it's really important that students graduate with kind of this better understanding of how, whatever field they enter, how they can, you know, improve the environment, you know, be stewards of it, and make sure that, you know, no matter what field it is, whether business, finance, you know, they're going to make sure that they practice sustainability principles no matter where they go into in the future.
One more clarification question. There was already this $2 per student per semester tax, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, with the vote just earlier this month, mm-hmm. Is that $2 being raised to $5, or is the $5 in addition to the $2?
It's two separate fees. So we have $5 for the sustainability fee, and the $5 is actually refundable as well, and then the $2 clean energy fee.
And the fact that students can get it back if they ask for it, do very many do that?
We're not sure. I mean, obviously we hope not, but I mean, there are concerns that, you know, like you said earlier, students do have to pay a lot of fees, and we kind of want to recognize that. And if students, you know, don't wish to pay for it, then, you know, that's absolutely their right to refund it. But, you know, we hope that students recognize that, you know, this fee is going to really go towards a lot on campus and go a long way. So we hope that too many won't refund the fee.
Okay. For students who may be listening to this program as they're driving back to campus after having been gone on spring break for a week, What's your short argument for why they shouldn't ask for the money back?
Because anyone on campus can apply for this funding, including students, and one of the primary goals of this fund is to really help students become educated so that when they graduate, they understand sustainability principles, and you're going to use these. And people who hire you are going to say, oh, wow, you know, he has an excellent understanding of why we need to take care of the environment. He's far better than our other applicants. Let's go for him.
All right, thank you. We've been talking with Joe Tang, who is president of the student board of the University of YMCA and has been president of the Students for Environmental Concerns organization on campus. We're talking about student activism, and Ellen Dahlke has just come back. She's also in our studio from a idealist conference. What was the idealist conference about, Ellen?
It was actually, Steve, it was idealist.org, which is this incredible nonprofit resource for me. It's been a resource for looking for internships over the summer, but it's also for jobs, volunteer opportunities, just a way for people who are working for social justice or environmental justice and any kind of issue like that to connect with each other, to share ideas. It's kind of a play on both idealist, obviously, and idea list, two words. So the conference was this weekend downtown Chicago, and I learned a lot about what students on campuses all over the states are doing, and I think I got a lot of great ideas about how I can incorporate those into some of the projects I'm doing on campus here.
Now, spring break was this last week, and you could have been in Florida, some other places with friends having a party. Why did you choose to go to idealist.com conference?
.org. Because social justice issues are important to me, and it's also fun to think about the way that the world could be if, you know, maybe more of us were idealists and worked for an ideal world for all of us.
How did you hear about this conference?
Just because, like I said, I'm a user of idealist.org. I use their resources that they provide for students and check it out constantly, and it was just advertised on there. Also, I heard about it from a friend of mine who works at the University Y.
Now, you're involved with another organization at the University Y, Vis-a-Vis. Tell us what that strange name means.
Vis-a-Vis. There's speculation among those of us coordinating Vis-a-Vis what it actually means. It's a program that's been around for 25 years, so we inherited it. But some of our old literature says volunteers in schools, a vital instructional service. So that's what we work with,
But it's a tutoring program.
It's a tutoring program, okay. Volunteer tutoring program. We take, we don't have all of our stats in from last semester yet, but we do have, I can roughly estimate that last semester we had between 400 and, say, 475 students from the University of Illinois that we interviewed and placed in the local K-12 schools, both public and private, Champaign and Urbana. And like I said, they were K-12, so some of them were working with younger students more in the classroom aid capacity. And then for the older students, we try to set university students up in one-on-one placements with high school students, junior high students.
Now, Ellen, I happen to know that your major is English. Why are you involved in this tutoring program?
Right, I am an English major, but I'm a secondary education minor, which means that once I graduate, I will hopefully have my certification in both in secondary education, which means 6 through 12. I'm passionate about education, and I think that English is relevant to that because, you know, Steve asked me when I walked into the studio today about the book that I'm holding. I'm reading Invisible Man, and we had a short conversation about how there's so much to cover in that book, you know, that I think that anytime you read a book, you pull out issues of identity, whether that be gender identity, racial identity, socioeconomic, and millions of other issues that I could go on for days. But I think that those are also issues that are important to tutors working with students, that, you know, you need to be aware of who that student is, who you are, and what you can reciprocally give to each other.
Now, some of the students who volunteer to be tutors one-on-one or as a classroom aide in the schools aren't in education, but they still donate, 2 hours a week to be in the school's tutoring?
Right. We don't have a minimum amount of time that we ask our volunteers to give. We're happy that they want to give. And no, we don't ask for education majors because it's everyone's job to be socially responsible for our children and our older students, too. And it's not just teachers, and it's not just future teachers. It's about community. And a large part of what I think is so cool about Vis-a-Vis is that it enables college students to get off campus and spend time working in the community, because if you don't learn that in college, you're going to have to learn sometime, and it's great practice.
Ellen Dahlke, that we've been talking with, and Joe Tang are two student activists that we have in the studio with us today for this live program. If listeners have a question or comment for them or for our third guest we'll be getting to in just a moment, do give us a call. Anywhere the program is heard, if it's a long-distance call to Champaign-Urbana, do use our toll-free number. That's 1-800-222-9455. If it's a local call, we have several lines that people in Champaign-Urbana may use. 333-9455 will reach all of those. Our third guest today is Jen Gaddis, and she's involved with a group called Engineers Without Borders. Now, what is that?
Engineers Without Borders is actually an international organization. Our chapter here focuses on three main things: international development with respect to international projects, sustainability of the United States, which is where our local projects come in, and also, since we are on a campus environment, we want to build student and community skills and awareness related to sustainability issues. So a little bit more specifically, the Engineers Without Borders mission is to partner with communities both domestically and abroad to address basic quality of life issues in a manner that is socially, environmentally, and economically sustainable.
So these are student engineers. There's also
Yes.
a program of Engineers Without Borders of people who are out practicing
somewhere,
We have
right? both student and professional chapters.
Okay.
So, yes.
And how long has there been a student chapter on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana-Champaign?
Our chapter was founded in the spring of 2003 with about three members. And since then, we've grown to about 150 active members, but a little bit less active members. So people who come to some of our events and subscribe to our weekly newsletter, we have over 1,200 of those. So that's in a period of 4 years.
We have a couple callers waiting. Let me go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our three guests. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I haven't been able to focus entirely on the program, but I was wondering whether the student activists there are at least familiar with the people that are working on the sort of the student anti-sweatshop movement. The sweatshop movement, anti-sweatshop movement, has sort of been institutionalized, I think, at the U of I, and that some of the committees that oversee the licensing of the logos, et cetera, have mechanisms where they check on those workplaces to make sure that the stuff that's benefiting the U of I through these licensing agreements is not being made by sweatshops, so that whatever logo you choose to wear doesn't represent something other than what you want it to mean, in the sense of representing exploitation of workers. And related to that, I don't know if they know about the. I think some of the Latino students are involved in hosting the Immokalee workers who are coming up. I think it's in a couple of weekends. And it's at the Channing Murray Foundation. There'll be reception for these folks who are trying to do a secondary boycott about the tomatoes that go to McDonald's, I guess. And they're going to be at Channing Murray, just right off campus, I guess one might say. And I don't know if they know any of the specifics on that, or they liaise with people that are working on that issue, and whether they might have something to say about that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you for those questions. We'll let Joe Teng respond.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with exactly the details, but one of the programs at the Y is Students for Economic Justice, and they actually used to be called United Students Against Sweatshops. I'm familiar with some of the people there. It's a smaller group, but one of the main things that they're working on is something called the Designated Suppliers Program, and this is kind of an idea that's been adopted by a lot of other large universities, and it kind of sets like this minimum for labor standards and wages for garment workers making collegiate apparel. And I know that this is something that SCJ, Students for Economic Justice, they've been working on over the past couple of years, and I think they've got kind of a mixed response from the university. They've met with the chancellor and the president before, and they've made some progress, but the university has yet to fully, you know, want to adopt the exact designated suppliers program, but they are working on, you know, trying to get that done. SCJ, this same group, they're actually, in the next couple of weeks, they're going to be traveling to outside Chicago to go to the McDonald's headquarters, and I believe that's related to what you were saying about with the tomato workers. So, yeah, there are groups that are certainly involved with that, and that kind of brings me to another issue, which is a problem with student activism in whole, and I digress a little, but, you know, kind of like what you want to work on. Every day students are kind of bombarded every single day with, oh, you know, do this and that and this. All these issues are so important, so how do you choose what, you know, you want to work on? I think that's one of the hardest things to do, but as student activists, I think our primary goal is to just get students motivated about something.
And on the sweatshop issue, Ellen Dahlke is indicating she has a comment, too.
Right. Thank you, Joe, for mentioning how hard it is to pick your issue as a student activist. Actually, I was on the planning committee for a student activist conference that we hosted at the Y earlier this month, and one of our workshops was entitled Picking Your Issue, because it's overwhelming. Do you work, should you base your work in your community? Should you have more of a global mindset? And one of our speakers was a man named Luis, who represented Coalition for Immokalee Workers. And he kind of presented that case and told us about what they've been doing. And you're right, Joe, they are going up to the McDonald's headquarters in Oak Brook very soon, next week maybe.
Thank you for that.
Positive.
And I wanted to get back to Jen Gaddis in just a moment with some more information about Engineers Without Borders, but we do have another caller waiting. Let's go to line number two. Line two, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Thank you. I'm 71 years old, and I'm a U of I graduate. And my question to you is, I know that this program is very, very important. I consider myself an idealist and my spouse and our kids. Anyway, my question is, do you have to be an idealist, and how much does the conference cost? I'll hang up and listen.
Was the conference just for students that idealist.org had, or was it open to people who are older?
It was open to all ages. It was the idealist.org's campus conference, so the main audience was students, but idealist.org is not just for students. It's for people of all ages.
And was it expensive to attend?
The conference fee was $185.
And so, you had to find your own housing in addition, or did that cover that?
No, you also had to have housing.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you for that call. Let me give the numbers again for others who might have a question or comment for our guests, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455. And that includes people listening via their computers at WILL.UIUC.EDU. This program is streamed live, so people can hear it around the world on the computers, but we can only take toll-free calls from within the continental U.S. at this number, 1-800-222-9455. I mention that because we will be having an international guest next Sunday. We'll be talking by phone live to the West Bank of Jerusalem, Palestine, talking with John Sutherland, who will be our guest next week here on Keeping the Faith, and listeners may call in about that, but only people from, as I say, the continental U.S. Have access to this toll-free number, although we will be talking to one person beyond that, and that will be our guest, Pastor John Sutherland. Well, let's get back to Jen Gaddis. We didn't give her much time talking about Engineers Without Borders. And tell us a little bit more about why students who are studying engineering get involved in this.
Sure. If I could really quickly address our last caller, though.
Of course.
Just in terms of Engineers Without Borders really tries to do a lot of events that are of interest to all members of the campus and Champaign-Urbana community. So all of the events that we organize in terms of lectures, workshops, demonstrations, and hands-on activities, those are all open to the public. So you don't necessarily need to go to a conference in other locations. You're welcome to get involved with my organization as well as, I'm sure, SECS and vis-a-vis. A lot of the student organizations welcome community involvement as well.
All right. And all of the organizations we've mentioned so far, people can find out about them at the University YMCA website. That's universityymca.org, and you can click on any of these various organizations and get their websites and learn more about how to be involved in any of them.
Okay, so to return to your question, why do engineers need a working knowledge of sustainability? In my opinion, really the idea is that a lot of the problems that we face today in terms of resource usage and pollution and social problems, those aren't really created by people who don't have an education. So the idea is we need to educate people with the right types of design tools such that when they go into the world, they can make projects that are worthwhile and improve quality of life for all those involved. So
What type of an engineer are you?
I'm a materials engineer. So in my background, basically how I've contributed to sustainable development, if you will, is through developing materials that are used for solar energy conversion. So basically solar cells, like the solar panels that you see in people's houses. I've worked to improve the materials that are used for that conversion.
How long will it be till that's more cost effective?
In my opinion, it's entirely a political issue. So basically you have to realize that all energy is subsidized. So if there were to be a more level playing field in terms of looking at energy policy. So if you were to include all the environmental and social implications of where fossil fuels and so on are coming from, the playing field really would be much more leveled. So I think that a lot of it comes from where government interests are located and also just what the public accepts. So it's not necessarily that we have technological limitations. It's sort of a mixture of problems.
We're talking with three student activists here in the studio today. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. We talk about issues of ethics and values as well as religion and spirituality. And today we're focusing almost entirely upon ethical issues, value issues. And our three guests are all current students at the University of Illinois. We've just heard the voice of Jen Gaddis from Engineers Without Borders, the student chapter. And Joe Tang is the president of the student board at the University YMCA and former president of Students for Environmental Concerns and still very active in that very successful program here on this campus. And Ellen Dahlke from Vis-a-Vis, which deals with tutoring, and also has just returned from the idealist.org student conference in Chicago this last weekend. Coming up, as I mentioned, on Keeping the Faith next week, since we're about halfway through our program today, our guest will be Pastor John Sutherland, talking to us live via telephone, if everything works correctly, from the West Bank in Palestine. And we'll be talking with him on Palm Sunday about Palm Sunday in the Holy Land. Our guest on April 8th, the following Sunday, will be several folks from the Niagara Foundation in Chicago that deals with the one of the Islamic movements in this country, the Fethullah Gulen movement. So on Easter Sunday, we'll be talking with Muslims about this particular movement within Islam. On April 15, we'll have the Campbells as our guest, who will be talking about green funerals. How can you have a green burial in this country? There's a lot of interesting talk about that, and a local group in Champaign-Urbana will be hosting the Campbells as their special speaker later in April. But we'll be talking with them April 15 on the radio. And for those who want to see them in person, they'll be here April 23rd at the Provena Covenant Hospital Auditorium at 7 p.m., talking to the Funeral Consumers Association in this area about green burials. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. We have a varied program, as you see. The students in the studio are smiling at how varied it is. And you're all too young to have to think about burials, I understand. But for some of us, it's a more current topic. Let's see. This program is sponsored in part by the University Y. And coming up at the Y this week, on Tuesday at New University at the noon lecture, we'll be learning about The Ninth Letter, the literary arts magazine at the University of Illinois, and Jody Stanley, the editor, will be speaking and answering questions. This is a free lecture on March 27th, this coming Tuesday noon at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street, right across from Lincoln Hall, easily accessible by bus for people in the community and walking distance, of course, for people on campus. Coming up this coming Friday, the guest will be Cynthia Campbell, who is the current president of McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago. She'll be talking as part of the Friday Forum series on differing faiths in the public arena, the various conflicts and yet opportunities for cooperation that there are. She'll be talking about how people from different faiths, specifically Christians, can live well in a multi-faith society. She is the ninth president and the first female president of McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago. That's Cynthia Campbell at the Y this Friday, March 30th at noon. If you'd like to reserve a lunch, do call the Y, 217-337-1500. But if you forget, come anyway, and you can find food or bring food if you like. The wonderful Thai eatery is there, and a lot of good Thai food is available. Well, let's get back to our guests for today. We're talking about student activism, and we have three students who Did you come back early from spring break, or did any of you actually go and do something fun over spring break? Joe, you went camping, I know. Was that for environmental reasons or just for fun, too?
No, I went camping down to the Shawnee National Forest for a few days, and it was great. I've never been to Southern Illinois. It's kind of nice to see what the state has to offer besides, kind of the scenery around here.
Now, where did you grow up? Where did you come from to the University of Illinois?
I was born and raised in Houston, Texas. I'm very proud of that. And I came here to the University of Illinois. I liked it a lot when I came to visit. So.
And what do you study here?
I'm a senior in environmental science.
All right. And Jen, what about you? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Rockford, but I sort of have a less traditional past, if you will. I didn't actually go to high school there. I homeschooled so that I could travel around a little bit more and have more freedom in my education. So I spent some time in a variety of places, but that's, I suppose, what I would call home.
And who helped you decide that this homeschool route was a good one to take?
Well, my parents kind of saw that my interests are varied, and when I get interested in something, I tend to be very passionate about it and want to be able to really decide what I think is important and learn from people who I think are leaders in those fields. And at the school where I was at, that type of educational environment didn't really exist. So it was really just to improve the quality of the experience, if you will.
And when you say you traveled around, so you not only were educated at home by your parents, but by who else?
I basically contacted family, friends, and my parents' colleagues and so on, and asked them, so, hey, if I were to come live with you for a few months, would I be able to sort of see what you're doing, learn about your field for part of the time, and then pursue my own studies for part of the time as well? So it's just a way to have a more interactive learning experience.
So, sorry, I'm just very curious. tell me one example of a friend of your parents or a friend somehow you went and stayed with, and what did you learn?
Well, I'll give you an example about how I got into my present field, which is material science. My brother was actually getting a master's degree at Ohio State in material science and engineering. So I said, hey, can I come be a lab assistant for you and see what it's all about and see if I like engineering? So he set up a 2-month internship with his professor where I got to go work in his lab and learn about what he was doing while living there and also doing my own studies. So that's just an example.
Thank you. And Ellen Dahlke, where did you grow up?
A much less exciting educational experience than Jen, I have to say. I grew up just outside Chicago on the south side in Evergreen Park.
And how did you pick the University of Illinois?
I didn't really have that wide-searching college experience. I just...
It was the state university.
The state university wanted to stay in state. It was a bargain, basically, yeah.
And have you been pleased that you've been
here? I've been very pleased. I've really become attached to University of Illinois and especially the Champaign-Urbana community, probably because of my work with the schools. But, I've really grown to love it down here.
Now, when you came here as a first-year student, how did you hear about this tutoring program that you got involved in?
A friend of mine, well, he wasn't a friend at the time, but we became friends, actually just handed me a flyer on quad day and said, are you interested in working with high school students? And I said yes, because that was what my plan was. And so it was a pamphlet for Vis-a-Vis. Sounded like a really cool, really legit program. So I checked it out, went to an info night, spent a semester as a tutor, and then interviewed for staff and have been with it ever since.
Tell us how Vis-a-Vis is organized.
Okay. We're kind of on a 3-level system. We have our volunteer base who obviously wouldn't have a program without the volunteer base, and they're pretty large, and they're dedicated and wonderful. And out of that volunteer base, we have we select people who tell us that they're interested in getting more involved with the program on a more administrative level. And we hold interviews at the end of each semester and take on a few as coordinators. The coordinators are the people who really do the legwork for the program. They interview, they hold 3 office hours a week, and they volunteers sign up for interviews with them, and they come in. It's more like an appointment because we don't really put our volunteers through a lot to get into the program. There's a background check involved, of course, and a little bit of medical testing, but
a background check
because they're working with students,
with kids in the public schools.
It's absolutely necessary. Sure. And then myself and my co-director, Michael Good, who's a sophomore here, kind of administrate from very far back from the volunteer base and from the students, which is unfortunate. And to kind of balance that, I just volunteer also myself, so I get back into the schools, and so I don't feel too distant from what I'm doing.
And you'd said earlier in the program that you have between 400 and 500 university college students who volunteer to do this tutoring.
Right. When I came into the program, there it was the years had gone by, and the volunteer base had kind of decreased a little bit. So last year, we just really stepped it up as far as recruiting, because there's not a shortage of people on this campus that want to work with students.
And there's younger. A lot of need.
And there's also a lot of need. So we just tapped into that and, like I said, just kind of stepped it up, and it's really helped. We've really increased our numbers.
Now, tell me what a teacher does to get a student volunteer through Vis-a-Vis.
Well, we try to be proactive and let the teachers know that we're out there. We send packets to all of the local schools that we can think of or contact, and we're always looking for new people to send information about us to. And those packets have information about Vis-a-Vis and also request forms. And then those teachers fill out request forms either for their classroom, if they're working with younger students and they just want someone in the classroom with them to help kind of work the group, and or we a lot of counselors fill them out for students for one-on-one placements, and then they fax them to us, email them to us, mail them to us. We put them in our computer database and then get rolling.
And what's the result for a student? Tell me a story.
I've been working with the student for 2 years now, 3 years almost, who...
How old?
Now he's a sophomore. He was an eighth grader when I started. But I don't think that I'm really... I mean, we're tutors, we're not mentors, so there's an academic capacity with what we do. But I don't think that what's great about the relationship that I've established with this student is that his grades are improving, because they may or may not be. I don't really pay that close attention to what grades he's getting. But the fact that I'm there every week, and even though he knows that I'm busy and I often have my book bag with me with all my homework, that I'm still there every week. And I don't mean to, I mean, it's not just me, but I can speak from my own experience that I know that there is a sort of trust relationship that builds. And I think that it's important for any student, whether they're an at-risk, whether they're labeled as at-risk or not, I think it's important that they have older examples of academic success to spend time with them every week and to affirm their value. Because if an older kid comes in and wants to spend time with me every week, he must think I'm cool. She must think I'm cool. She must think I'm worth it. And personally, I've seen that develop with the student that I work with. But I mean, obviously, it must 400 to 500 times that's happening, and that's cool. It makes it worthwhile for me when I know personally what can happen.
And those grade school, middle school, high school kids may not be getting that kind of example from their peers,
right? Teachers are great examples of academic success too, but there's only one teacher in a classroom, and so Vis-a-Vis just tries to kind of help them out and not take their place or not nothing. You know, we try to be really humble about what we do, but we just to go in and do what we can when they ask us to.
Joe Tang, tell us a little bit about what you've gained from being a student activist during your senior now.
Yes.
And so you've been pretty active for 4 years in a number of different programs. What have you gained personally from it?
I guess that's a hard question. It wasn't, as an incoming freshman, I mean, I kind of was like a lot of other students. I was here to learn, to party, and, you know, have a good 4 years and then graduate and continue on my life. But kind of what Student Activists has done for me is it's kind of opened up this whole new world of, you know, what an individual is really capable of doing with their time. I think one of the hardest things about being a student is, like I said earlier, there's all these different issues that you can work on. And then one of the really cool things about being an activist is especially involved in something that you're really passionate about. For me, that's the environment. You can kind of see that impact that you have with the time, whether or not it's like coordinating a lecture and, you know, or helping, you know, volunteer here and there. It's really, you kind of see what the capacity you have to do for good is. And then what, for me in particular, like, I really enjoy what I study in class, but that's not everything you get from the college experience. Being a student activist has really exposed me to other people. It's helped me, you know, coordinate different events. And there's, I would say my college experience wouldn't be complete without, you know, what I've done outside of the classroom, because you learn, you know, from PowerPoints or reading a book, but then you also learn from going out, meeting people, getting involved, and, you know, finding out, you know, in detail to what you, whatever limit that you want to do. And then, yeah, you know, just that way when you graduate, you have not just, you know, like book knowledge, but you have kind of, I suppose you could say street smarts about, you know, how you can apply that to whatever field you go towards.
Jen Gaddis, I know you're interested in education reform. Tell us about that.
So like Joe was sort of mentioning earlier, it's important for people from all majors to say, okay, what should I be doing with my skills, with this aspect of life that I'm working on, such that I can make a better place for people? And so that's the basic idea behind education reform. Like, how should we use our skills and our time at this university to really make sure that students graduate knowing how they can make a difference, knowing like what it is to make a good decision with respect to humanity and the environment and all kinds of issues versus what the textbook approach is. Like, it's just sort of a way of looking at how can we reduce exploitation of people and resources and really improve the way we design things. So the goal behind education reform is really not so much, okay, so you can approach it two ways. You can create new classes that focus on whatever issue it is that you want to address, or you can actually create those principles, like incorporate them into the basic classes that everyone's actually required to take, which is much more effective because then you actually ensure that not just the people who are interested in those very side issues take those classes, but you ensure that everyone is exposed to those principles such that when they graduate, they have those skills in the back of their minds and they know sort of a basic understanding of the ethical implications of their actions. So, go ahead.
I was just curious to ask you the same question I asked Joe and Ellen earlier. What have you personally gained? Here you are in an engineering curriculum, mm-hmm. studying materials science, and you have this huge, heavy academic load that engineers all have to climb over, and yet you've taken extra time to do this kind of thing through Engineers Without Borders. What have you gained from it?
Well, I think it's especially important for me to see these types of results actually being applied. So in our projects with communities, seeing how taking a sustainable approach to engineering, so with appropriate technologies, how that can actually benefit communities. That's really what I like to see. And with our local work, seeing people become interested and aware of these issues and seeing them actually then work towards these goals is really, to me, the main benefit. So actually seeing the effects and inspiring people to think about these issues a little bit.
So you get a sense of satisfaction from seeing that kind of education happen.
Right. So, for example, how all Engineers Without Borders projects work, we take the model for sustainable development in that we aren't actually going to communities and saying, you need to do this, you need to do that, this will improve your life, everything will be great. How it works is individual communities identify a need of their own, and then they actually submit an application to the national chapter of Engineers Without Borders. And then as an individual university or professional chapter, we can go through all of those applications and say, okay, well, we have the skills and we have the people and we have the money necessary to actually work with this community. And so then what happens is we actually open, so we initiate a dialogue with that community. We look at their local environment, the people who live there, and we try to work with them to provide a solution that actually works for them and their specific need. So having the experience of working with those communities, I think, is really key for a lot of the people within the organization.
Do engineers get a break at spring break, or do you have to work the whole time?
Some do. Some do. I'm not one of them. but many do, yeah. And actually, the community has really played an important part in a lot of our projects. Our first project was in Orissa, India. It was a biofuel electrification project to provide lighting and income generation for a community there. And we raised about $2,000 just from the campus community and from door-to-door solicitations of money, and that was about 20% of the entire project budget. And that project was extremely successful. It's been internationally recognized. So we decided, okay, well, we did a pretty good job with that project, so we're going to take on an even bigger project. So right now we have a project in Enugu State, Nigeria, which is a country that the Peace Corps has actually pulled out of. So that country has a lot of problems. And there aren't a whole lot of organizations who are actually doing work there. So what we're trying to do is supply a locally managed water source for approximately 10,000 people. We have about 40 student engineers working on this project. And the issue that we're facing now is we need to raise about $100,000 over the next semester in order to make this project move forward. So once we have the infrastructure in place, the water supply is there, it will benefit generations to come. But until we can actually raise those funds, we're sort of at a standstill as to how much we can really do there.
Let me share a little bit of information that I learned several different ways, actually. One of them was because this person has been a guest on this show before, actually twice. And this is a program that provides a good water source in another country in Africa, in Malawi. And the person's name is Tom Logan, L-O-G-A-N. And it's through a group called the Marion from Marion, Illinois, the Marion Medical Mission. And they have developed some very appropriate technology for shallow wells in Malawi and I think now Kenya. And there might be some things you could learn from their website.
Okay.
And from Tom Logan and Marion.
Well, thank you.
Not to keep you from discovering new things, but there may be some that have already been found that a system that works pretty well, mm-hmm. and that has been sustainable. I know that's been going on for a number of years now, and that's a very good program. There's so much illness and death, of course, that comes particularly to children because of not having good water supplies around the world, and Africa is one of those places. Let me get the phone numbers again. We're down to our last 10 minutes or so of Keeping the Faith this Sunday evening. This is a live show, and we encourage listeners to make a comment or question for our guests in Champaign-Urbana. You may reach several local lines by punching in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL here on AM 580. Elsewhere, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455 for a toll-free call. So toll-free 1-800-222-WILL. We are eager to have others join the conversation. Our guests today are three student activists from the University of Illinois, and we could have chosen from literally hundreds. As you've heard, the three we have here are involved in programs and have hundreds of other university students. Often people get the idea from looking at things like MTV that all students do is cause trouble and drink too much and so forth, and that's a long way from being true. That tends to be what a lot of the news media portrays, but of course on public radio and public TV we can provide a more balanced perspective. Joe Tang, tell us what some of the students that are involved in a program called Alternative Spring Break have been doing the last week.
Sure, yeah. Alternative Spring Break is a really large organization at the university, and as the name implies, they send students on trips during spring break, summer break, winter break, and Thanksgiving break. And instead of, you know, kind of your usual student trip, they actually do service trips, and all around the nation, everything from, you know, working with environmental issues, habitat restoration. They do a lot of, you know, social issues. They've been in Washington, D.C. to help poverty there.
Homelessness.
Yeah, exactly. They've helped migrant workers in Texas. So they send about 28 trips every single year over every single break to all places around the nation. And it's a really great organization to be involved with.
And groups of students will go in two vans, 12 students at a time, study a project in advance, go and do a service project, come back to the Champaign-Urbana community, and then work in perhaps on a United Way agency locally around that same issue that they've studied and gotten involved with somewhere else. It's because there are migrant workers, of course, in this area too, and there's homelessness issues and there's Habitat for Humanity here. And so I know the students do a local project as well as what they do off on break once they get back in a couple weekends after they've recovered. But it's a great program. And I think last year there were over 300 students who chose to do that over some of their breaks. Alternative spring break, but it's also the other three breaks now that it's possible for universities to have. Tell us about some of the other student activist groups that are involved that you know about here on campus.
Sure. Yeah, some of the groups involved with the Y are, just to name a couple, we have Amnesty International. They, of course, work on human rights issues around the world. And one of the events that they're trying to organize is an ultimate Frisbee competition, and all the proceeds from that will go to benefit the genocide in Darfur, or I should say benefit people who are working against the genocide in Darfur. We also have Students Improving the Lives of Animals. They're actually working on trying to get a ban on the Ringling Brothers circus from coming to the university because that circus has a lot of recorded animal rights issues. Then we have Campus Vegetarian Society. They have biweekly potlucks and trying to, you know, kind of increase awareness on why being a vegetarian is a good way to go. And they're actually this Saturday going on a restaurant tour. They're going to three different restaurants in Chicago, vegetarian restaurants. We also have the Green Observer. They just put out an issue on urban sprawl. It's kind of a collection of different articles about environmental issues going around at the university, community, and also around the nation. There's also the Korean Student Association and the Philippine Student Association, which work on, of course, cultural awareness. Red Bison is a group that maintains a small piece of land for prairie use over in Savoy. And then, as we mentioned earlier, we have Students for Economic Justice, and one of their primary goals is to work on getting the designated suppliers program adopted by the university. I'd also like to mention that the week of April 16th, Students for Environmental Concerns, we're coordinating a couple of events for Earth Week. We plan on having a couple of speakers. First, we have Professor Steve Long, and we hope that he'll speak on the new Energy Biofuels Initiative. And then we're also bringing in a keynote speaker, Omoyele Sowore. He's a Nigerian student activist. He's going to come and talk to us about the conflict in Nigeria and the social and environmental impact that that's had. And then we'll also be having a bike tune-up, a concert. And that Saturday, we're going to have a Boneyard Creek cleanup, which is a large community event. A lot of students can get involved with that.
We're talking today with three student activists from the University of Illinois campus in Urbana-Champaign. All of them are involved in programs that are through the University YMCA. The University Y is unusual. It doesn't have a pool or a gym or a fitness center. But for 134 years, the Y has been involved in this campus in providing opportunities for students to be involved in social action, in community service, educational projects, and it's been a wonderful organization on this campus for all these decades. The student leaders we have in the studio with us today are examples of some of the concerns. If you missed the earlier parts of this program, it's available via computer at will.uiuc.edu, and all the programs of Keeping the Faith are archived there. So if you've missed this program or the first part of it, take the opportunity to find it on your computer and go to AM 580 and then Keeping the Faith, and you'll see these programs listed there so that you can access them at your convenience. Our three guests today have been talking about specific programs they've been involved with, but I've been asking all the questions. So do you have anything that I haven't asked about that you'd like to tell me about any of the programs you've mentioned so far?
I'd like to just address one thing that you said earlier, Steve, about how it's a long way from the truth to think that all students are, you know, drinking too much and smoking too much and only here to have fun and you know, get their degree, but also party. And I think that's very true. And I don't think that Joe or Jen or I or our people or students who care more than our counterparts who aren't involved in the activities that we are. Joe and Jen, I think you guys are doing incredible work and works with real results that we're seeing. But I don't think that students that aren't involved with activities like this aren't caring as the way that Joe and Jen and myself care. I think that it's our task to make action about that care and that compassion. And, you know, we're not more compassionate people than the people that are, you know, sitting on the couch watching MTV. We're not. But I think that it's our task to
make action
easier. And not easier in the sense that, you know, world change and social change and even change on this campus are easy. They're not easy things, but I think that that's a challenge to us to make action accessible to our peers.
It's interesting that on this campus there is this long heritage of the various religious foundations and other groups that are not religious but very much involved with social action that includes students, and students are invited to be part of it. Some students can go through 4 years and never discover the right niche to get involved with, and I think that's unfortunate. That's one reason I'm delighted you all were willing to take an hour out of your busy lives to come talk about it on the radio. But because there are so many opportunities for students, and these days the university even officially is encouraging it. The Chancellor's Task Force, Richard Herman's Task Force on Civic Engagement, is trying to find ways that students can even get more academic credit for being involved in civic life, in community life, in activism. So there's official support for the university. The university, through Amy Spotsler's office, what's the official name?
Office of Volunteer Programs.
Office of Volunteer Programs. There's money coming in from United Way to help fund that program. So that's another way students can learn about opportunities to be involved. Jen, I see you and Joe nodding your heads. You want to join in?
Sure. I think that that's one of the main issues, is that how do you get students involved initially? Because I think that most people, you know, they have an idea that these issues need to be addressed, but they don't necessarily know how to go about doing it. So if you can get them involved once and they see, okay, I can make a difference doing this, then it sort of perpetuates the cycle of, okay, well, then what's the next step? So I think that it's really important that the university does sanction these types of activities and makes it actually incorporated into the curriculum, such that students, all students, are required to have that sense of civic engagement and ethical responsibility to communities, so that when they experience in their classes, they say, hey, this is a pretty cool thing that I'm doing, and then they take it beyond the classroom.
So, yeah, I'm going to try and wrap it up with what I think are kind of like the three things. First off, you have to recognize that the goal after you graduate shouldn't be to make a lot of money, but it should be to really make the world a better place in whatever field that you are. The second is that the time on campus, you have 4 years to do a lot besides study. Get involved. The time you put into a lot of whatever program you're involved with is really important. And then lastly, you have to understand that you as an individual, you can make the difference, and we really can add a lot to what we can do on campus.
Well put.
That's a great summary. Thank you so much. Joe Tang, Ellen Dahlke, Jen Gaddis, our guest today on Keeping the Faith. At the Y at noon on Tuesday, Know Your University. The guest will be the editor of the Literary Arts magazine at the University of Illinois, Ninth Letter. Jody Stanley will be our guest on Friday. This Friday noon, Cynthia Campbell, president of McCormick Theological Seminary, will be talking about a Christian approach to religious diversity. Friday Forum, noon on Friday. At the Islamic Mosque, coming up on March 31st, is a speech by Dr. Jamal Badawi on the meaning of jihad, and the meaning might surprise you. That's afternoon, 1 to 6 p.m., discussion and documentaries and dialogue at Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, March 31st. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Tariq Ramadan has been called the Muslim Martin Luther King, and he's often described as Europe's most important Muslim intellectual. Hundreds of young Muslims turn up at his talks, and tapes of his lectures are widely circulated. He's trying to build bridges between European Muslims and conservative clerics. I'm Jim Fleming. We'll talk with Tariq Ramadan next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7, here on WILL Urbana. While there are many people in the world today who identify themselves as Christians, the church is not the dominant religious and cultural force that it once was. That, says the Reverend Charles Bayer, may be a blessing in disguise. It puts the church on the margins again, a cultural location, he says, that enables it to stand for and with most of the world's people. This morning on Focus 580, we'll talk with the Reverend Bayer about the connections between faith and social justice. I'm David Inge, the host. Focus 580, today at 10, here on WILL Urbana.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 50s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high in the upper 70s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low in the upper 50s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.